This presentation was recorded at DevOps Days 2010 in Mountain View, California. This audio file and others like it are available for free download on InfoQ.com.
I need a lot of questions because I'm only going to ask each one of these guys one question, and I'm not going to ask any more questions because I don't like to ask a whole lot of questions. So I'm going to start. What I want you to do is I got a specific question for each one of you, and what I want to do is just combine that with who you are. To make it real quick, and then if you don't ask questions, I'm actually going to pick you out of the audience and make you ask. So Ben, my first question, because you were supposed to be James Urquhart, right? And the question I have, like, so DevOps, and so I don't really like the premise. Does DevOps need cloud or cloud need DevOps? Ask that. That's not what we're going to do here. what we're going to do is Ben, you know, he'll tell you about his background, but he's a security expert. He's like a really, really smart guy, as all these guys are. But the thing is there's a thing that we hear a lot when we do these kind of, we blog about DevOps, and me and Damon do this podcast together. And I keep hearing like this, some other groups are coming in and saying, well, you're missing us and you're not including us. And the two that I hear a lot is security and NetOps. And they say, you know, you're being exclusive and you're not, you know, and we're just like trying to find our DNA, right? So my question, Ben, is like, what's that all about? Is there a legitimate complaint, or is it, you know, are we missing something here, or is it we're just kind of growing, we're trying to get our feet on the ground? Or I don't know if you've seen some of the complaints on Twitter or not. So what are your thoughts? I'm not talking about anybody in specific, yeah.
So I don't understand the question except to... Not from you, but the question in general.
Okay.
The name DevOps is unfortunate in that it leads people to various conclusions about it, whatever. The only question that people should really be asking themselves is, can integration of what I do with the rest of what everyone else around me in the business does make it work better for me and for them? And, you know, in the security space, I don't know how it couldn't be a good thing to, for example, have automation integrated into your infrastructure management, into your application management, into your deployment process, for a lot of the same reasons that it's really valuable to everyone else who already does that. You have a programmatic way to express how things should look. You have a programmatic way to audit whether things look that way. That seems like a pretty huge win on the face of it for folks doing security. So in that way, I don't understand how someone who spends a lot of time doing security operations would not want that. Now, folks who don't do operations but talk a lot about people who do operations may have trouble understanding that, and that is what it is. Similarly, in networking, you know, there are a lot of folks who are very interested in doing things the way that they have always done them. That's a common problem, not restricted to networking, but the culture in networking is not what it is in systems administration. And so the notion of even minimal automation is pretty alien to folks in networking. Manually maintaining configurations on all of your potentially hundreds or thousands of devices is common practice. That is just how it is done. And the tools for doing network automation simply are not up to the standards of what they are in the systems automation world. So I think there's a lot of misapprehension and cultural antipathy, but I don't think there is actually a legitimate reason why the things that we know and love about the DevOps culture would not be at least as effective in transforming networking and security.
Cool. Thank you, Ben. So Justin, for you to explain, you know, who you are, but so I had the opportunity to visit Justin's shop, and they've written a private cloud, which is really pretty interesting. And so the question I have for you after you introduce yourself is that so one of the things about, I think Israel Gad, I don't know if he's still here, he did a great podcast once where he's talking about that you can be agile all day long in your development, right? But if your ops is not agile, it becomes really a waterfall, right? You're kind of stuck. You're waiting. And so, what's your experience? We had some discussions at lunch, and I'd love to hear your thoughts about that kind of roadblock and how do you fix it?
Right. So, Justin Dean, I manage the infrastructure group for ShopZilla. So that includes, NetOps and the systems groups and storage and data center. So I definitely feel getting the other groups involved, and we're interesting enough actually including some of that stuff in our Cloud 2.0 project where we're automating pieces of the network and sort of moving that systems, something that's been inherent in the system world forever into the other groups. And it's kind of foreign at first, right? People are like, it's kind of risky because, like, if you automatically destroy all the load balancers in production, it's going to be a bad day, right? So, so there's definitely a lot of checks and balances and smarts and protections there has to be. But along the same lines, we have 50 million requests for services and servers, and now we're building servers really fast. And then a ticket gets fired off into a queue of the network team, and it's like, well, we can't actually go live with all the stuff we just built because it's not available on the network yet. So I definitely think there's a lot of room for improvement in that area across the board. So so back to the original question about the cloud, and I think maybe the easiest way for us to like look at what we've done and why we've done it is sort of go back to the reason why we went cloud internal. I know there's a lot of debate. People are like, why would you build an internal cloud and all that? So one of the biggest problems we've got is as our company has become really, really agile, right? There's tons of different small groups. Requests for servers just coming in from every different direction, right? So on the best case, right? So we've spent the last couple of years developing our automation toolkit to provision servers, right? We're using Puppet and everything. It's pretty good. Really fast. It's all the stuff around it that's slow, right? It's teams sitting in their iteration saying, hey, we want to build a widget, right? And what do we need? We need some dev servers. I don't really know what we need. And they try to figure out what they need. They don't really know. They wait to request us until it's a little bit too late. Request comes in. It's obviously important, right? For them, they're like, this is the most important thing ever, and it's going to cost us $1 billion if you don't hurry up and do it. So magnify that across all the splinter groups in the whole company, right? They're all coming in. So then we fire off our automation tools, build servers. So you're looking at, a couple days of, like, ticket time, right? Not actual deployment time, but sort of back and forth ticket time. What do you actually need? And going back and forth on that, right? Because it's actual, it was before sort of hardware that we allocate, and it's costly, and it needs to be the right stuff, and it needs to have the right specs. So the ticket would go off into the CM team. So now it's like we need to deploy the app on there and whatever. And then once the app is on there, so your best case, 8 days, or 7 days-ish somewhere, right? So now you get it. You don't have access to servers. It's missing something that you need, right? There's a new Perl module that's not on there, and now you're back and forth. So you're over a week. This is not good for anybody, right? Like we're getting yelled at all the time. Nobody wants to be in that position. You hear about clouds, right? And it's like, it's just very kind of spooky to get people in there. So we sort of went into it with the sole purpose of let's put some layer of glue on top of our automated system and go self-service. So basically what we did was we made it to where there's a portal that everyone in the company has access to. You go on there and you say, give me servers. Here's the name. Here's how much processor. Here's how much RAM. Here's how much disk. Or, we've simplified it and said small, medium, large. And how long? And how long do you need it? So that sort of ties into another whole problem we have is idleness. And how do you detect idle servers when you have thousands of them? And say, said multi-group or tons of dev teams have now just disappeared and move on to different projects. And now you have servers that are sitting there eating power and eating money away, and nobody has a clue how to detect it. So we went into it and said, let's make sure we have parameters in our cloud that kind of detects that, and let's go into it knowing that they're going to be temporary resources. So, and keep in mind, this is, we're not actually doing production in the cloud yet. We're still dev, QA, staging type stuff. But so we're really using it to as a paradigm shift. So we've, now that you can go onto this portal and you can within 2 minutes say, give me a cloud, and there's you get your own cloud and you put your own apps on it, and by the way, you get root access in our cloud. So, you know, that people love that, right? So it enables these dev teams to just go crazy with whatever they want to do, right? There's no wait time now. It's first day, start of iteration, you can write business logic. You don't have to wait 8 days or 10 days or whatever and then maybe get told no because we're short on servers or whatever. So we're using it to sort of change the thinking around servers because we've seen a lot of negative effects due to inefficiencies in this whole process prior to the cloud. So one of them is server hoarding. So, you know, if you've managed to get like 50 servers between you and your friends, it's like you don't ever give those back, right? Like,
yeah.
Just we have servers named stuff that apps that don't even exist anymore, right?
Server huggers, like, they call them now. Yeah. Server huggers.
So we're trying to get away from that thinking, right? And we're using this self-service portal to get people to think like it's disposable. Like, use it, throw it away, or, you know, we'll take it away, which I'll talk about that in a second. But throw it away, and then if you need another one, grab more. And also only take what you need, because you don't have to, you know, prior to cloud, right? It was, I need an 8-core box, 32 gigs of RAM minimum, to run my 1 gig JVM process on it. Mm-hmm. You're like, okay, awesome. That's exactly what you need. Right, so the way we're kind of dealing with that in the cloud is two main methods. So we have automated reclaiming, which is we've built processes in the cloud that goes and looks and sees, are you really using these servers anymore? So if there's 7 days of idleness, we will take it back, right? We'll send you an email and say, hey, it looks like you're not using your instances anymore, and we'll, you know, there's a few checks and balances there, but after like a couple of days, it's gone.
Repoman.sh.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Hey, why don't we get
some? Yeah, or I wanted to go through the panel. Yeah, well, I was just going to add two more questions. I'll make them quick. I want everybody to introduce. For you, J Clouds, right? So, what does DevOps mean? So, you've had a lot of experience working with different clouds, right? You've worked with GoGrid and you've built APIs and abstractions around that. So, what does DevOps mean from either standards or lock in, all the things we hear about, like, am I getting locked into this cloud or, you know, how do I work among multiple clouds? What is this? Does this make any sense in the DevOps story?
Well, I mean, if you think about DevOps being bringing some principles of development to operations, like the cloud is one of those things that you kind of need. I mean, one of the things, like, there's a lot of tools that are using JClouds now. One of them is that these guys are like, you know, wrapping stuff with a virtual box so that they can actually practice their deployments in their laptop before they make these big Uber mistakes and oh my God, I just spent $10 or whatever, you know. And some of it's that. I mean, and it's also if you look at the way that you're really looking at testing your stuff, you know, some of the more sophisticated tools that you have for cloud portability, like JClouds, have stub providers. So if you're really doing, you know, infrastructure as code, you don't want to wait for that API to come back, even if it is VirtualBox. So you want to be able to stub out your stuff and then boom, boom, boom. So, for example, you know, one of the customers that uses, it's open source, but, you know, the users of JClouds is Sonian. And the first thing they said was like, oh, this is cool that you can do like Rackspace and S3, and I don't have to worry about the differences. But the very next thing was like, wow, you can stub it out. I don't even have to connect. And if you think about that from, I mean, I've been doing ops a long time. I mean, my first like do-it script was deck to provision Lisp accounts on, you know, using DCO, and it got to number 5 because you saved it 5 times, and that's just what VMS does. But you know, nowadays, ironically, you know, I'm using Lisp again to provision cloud with the closure stuff. But you know, it just makes sense when you have this background. You know, you look at something like cloud technology, and it's like the next thing that you can like do a better job at. And so DevOps is just about doing a better job, in my opinion. And right now we've got this like IT renaissance, as I call it, where you've got all the right things around you that people can just do a better job, because all the, you know, the tools are there, the embracing of change is a lot higher than it has been in the past. So it's just the right environment.
Cool. And Joe, just my last question, just I want to give you a shout out. Joe works for Cloud Scaling, and you know, I'm a big fan of Randy Bias. Randy Bias is doing some phenomenal stuff with you know, kind of, I call it like a pass for private clouds, if you will. So, I mean, your whole story about building like super infrastructure on commodity infrastructure, how is that DevOps-ish?
Well, let me tell you who we're talking to, or who we're not talking to with some of our customers. Who's coming and contacting us is not the CTOs of organizations. It's not it's the product organizations. It's the people who are driving the business who want to have cloud computing platforms to deliver. So, Justin, you're doing exactly the right thing, because what we're seeing is if their IT organization isn't delivering these platforms that their developers can use, then they're going to go outside of the IT in order to get their cloud. Give me my cloud, damn it! And so you just got to build it. If you don't build it, then you're going to be worked around.
Cool. All right, I'm done. You're up.
Sure. So maybe tying the last visibility talking to this one. Before it was my responsibility. I put up on a very simple chart of global average CPU utilization in our environment, which somehow found its way into our CIO's hands. And he looked at it and went, "We're averaging 3%. Why should I be approving new hardware? You guys aren't using the hardware we already have." And then now it's my responsibility. I changed roles. So a couple of things we're doing, I think sounds a lot like Justin's environment. We built a cloud where machines, at least non-prod machines, automatically expire after a month. So that sort of helps the idle. But I also wrote a little tool it's on SourceForge called Idle Server. To your kind of comment about like, and it is a little bit of a trick of identifying what's an idle box, but right now, I mean, it looks for, are there any recent logins and are there any kind of non-standard processes running? First time we turned it on, came back, you know, 10% of the machines in our environment. No one had logged in 3 months and there was nothing but the standard Red Hat processes running, which is a little disturbing. But anyway, thought I'd mention those.
I mean, I just think that's one of the virtues of the cloud. So before I was at Cloud Scaling, I was at Engine Yard, and we would have our customers weren't operations; they were developers, and what they saw in their ecosystem is like, ooh, compute available via an API, I know this. I can program my application to get deployed, and so they would do so, and then they started combining their applications with other services. And Joe Williams is probably in the back. People would begin to use databases as services and start piecing their application together. And you know, in that world, there isn't any idleness. It doesn't exist. They flip on and flip off. And they're more worried about the top line. They're not really worried as much about the bottom line. So that's the world I think we're going to be entering into, where developers are going to be driving a lot of the demands on operations by wanting services available on tap.
I'll have like a little snarky response to that. And that's like, you know, back in the old draconian sysop days, right? You know, like, you know, it pissed me off, right? You have no account anymore. But you could, you know, kind of blame the cloud for being unreliable. Whoops, these VMs just disappeared.
That's funny. You want to get a question in?
Yeah. So for those of you that have built or are building dev QA clouds, how have you had a problem with things in there slipping into production? You know, basically people using it not just as a dev QA environment, but, you know, stuff there becomes, oh, no, you can't turn that off. No, you know, it's being used live by our customers across the internet now. And, you know, if you have had that problem, what steps have you taken to address that?
Yeah, you go next.
So in the nothing is new in cloud, there were actually instances of Amazon where developers had NFS mounted their desktops for production. So, probably. you know, if it is possible, it will happen.
But I mean, for instance, do you put in ACLs that would prohibit the dev environment from accessing the internet or from being accessed from the internet or anything like that?
SSH tunnels. And SSL Connect, and I mean, there's just there are all of these ways that people will find to bypass these things. So,
but at least they have to try to bypass them. They can't do it inadvertently.
You know, I actually think that that sets the wrong behavior pattern, because it puts them in this mode of saying, "I need to work around you," and nothing good comes of that. Right, you made me work around you, and that's why it went wrong.
You're
if you had just given me a way to do this, I would have done it the right way.
I'm thinking more of the inadvertent dependencies, you know, like a dependency on a non-production DNS server.
Sure, and
like
and
that.
The way How to test you... that is this, is again nothing to do with cloud. The way that you deal with those sorts of situations is you, the developers, who no doubt own your services because you are totally about owning your availability. Are doing fire drills regularly, and continuous deployment is, in fact, constant fire drilling, but there are all sorts of other ways that you can do it. What happens if you lose this data center? Well, you can theorize all you like. Ultimately, you need to turn it off and find out. Whatever breaks, you fix it so that it doesn't happen again, and then you turn off another data center, and you turn off another server, and sometimes someone else comes around and just turns off your servers to see what happens, right? Ultimately, your commitment to the availability of your services has to include drastic measures like that, or you do not know what will happen. Not cloud specific, but possibly easier to do in a cloud because no one has to go and press a button, right? You can have your API start actually stress testing these things by disabling pieces of infrastructure.
Cool. By the way, Ben was actually one of the original engineers on Amazon, so he's not anti-cloud, actually, if he sounds like it. Go ahead.
So some of you guys have been talking about how you can get, using the cloud, you're basically getting servers or hosts out to your developers much faster. Usually what I find is that, you know, servers are helpful, but developers actually want other things on there as well. They might want a load balancer, they might want access to some data, some service, some other things, and I'm curious what you're doing. Is there anything that you're doing to help enable them to get those faster as well?
So, yes. We've automated the deployment of the apps and give that also. That's also a self-service thing, so they can deploy whatever apps they want to. We're currently working on automating the load balancers so they can, you know, have another box on the UI that says, I'll take a VIP, please. So we're trying to get end-to-end ecosystem buttons. So that it's like nobody actually wants servers. They want systems. So it's sort of like give me website and hit button, and then it builds the website stack for them. So we're sort of working on that now.
So in the like the JClouds project, that was my first step towards this, like making things, you know, usable. And we did things like, for example, our test suite for, you know, any cloud, and why it takes time to actually do cloud portability is that, you know, what we do is essentially we install OpenJDK, and if I can get Java minus version to return that, I know that not only is my code right, but this cloud, you know, performs within 15 minutes or whatever it is that it's actually a usable, you know, piece of stuff. And that if you can install Java, you can install anything pretty much, right? So, second thing I did was work at Opscode. And, you know, because if you look at systems configuration management tools, that's where things get, you know, more exciting. And I mean, it sounds like a plugin, and it is in a way, but honestly, you know, where's the beef, right? If I have this image that, you know, doesn't really have a lot of, you know, sensors or any way to pull down, you know, its configuration or apply any changes to it, then it's not really that useful to me. And so, you know, I think that, you know, whatever you're doing, if you're in DevOps, you're either going to be using systems integration and systems configuration tools, or you're going to be building them. And for me, I chose the latter.
Or we can get the next question.
No, I think that there's going to be the capabilities of platforms are just increasing and increasing and increasing. So that's really your competitive landscape that you're going to be working in.
Okay, so you guys have been talking about enabling developers, you know, to a week to an hour, but giving them all this power, getting out of the way. If they don't go to you because you're not giving it to them, they'll go somewhere else. It's also making developers sort of take the driver's seat in ownership for their operations and uptime. This is an area of weakness in developers in general. They don't come out of little developer school with a lot of operational knowledge, with a lot of this is how we achieve resiliency and robustness and availability.
Did you give that in operations school, little operations school?
Yeah, well,
Devs being on a pager list was horrifying.
Well, I would just, yeah, so I guess
they were scared.
The hard knocks that you get when you start doing operations does give you that. The hard knocks that you get when you start doing development doesn't until you show up in an environment like this. So I guess my question is, there's this gap, and it's not traditional operations that the developers need to learn. It's a new kind. And in fact, what the ops folks need to teach the developers isn't that either. So I'm curious what people are doing to try to help bridge that gap, improve the developers in this area.
You want to do it?
Sure. So it's actually, this is a really interesting point because, you know, last year I was like bussing around Europe trying to talk about cloud, and we were like trying to predict what would be issues. And one thing is like, okay, if you write a real cloud app, then all of a sudden you've completely transferred the responsibility that had typically been in this separate entity for, you know, how many resources is going to consume. And, you know, and then fear sets in. It's like, oh, no, you know, this M&M's app is going to, like, cost me $1 million because they're just going to launch every node in the world to satisfy this thing that has no business value. And while it's really extreme example, there's some, you know, thing to consider here. And one of them is that as, you know, developers are used to doing, you know, very sophisticated testing now. And, you know, you look at advances and people can, like, speak cucumber and people know what it is and stuff. But, you know, how much your, you know, application expands and contracts and what impact that has monetarily, tools like what Paul Crano was talking about with the ability to you know, figure out how much something costs is important. And, you know, and then as far as the responsibility of DevOps, it's not like, I think the wrong answer is to say that, you know, ops need to learn from dev or dev need to learn from ops, and it's more as kumbaya as it sounds, more of a collaboration attempt, because that it's equally, you know, responsible for you know, the success of DevOps is you know, both sides of the fence learning, and, you know, or maybe even bullpenning a bit more, you know, and being next to each other, and you see a lot of lean startups doing that, and some of the work that Kaching was talking about as far as like the no department concepts.
So that basically says by the time you got everybody to the table doing the DevOps-y thing, they're going to be doing the right things and thinking in the right way to fill the gaps in, like as part of that process.
Follow Yellow Brick Road.
Sounds a little little optimistic, but I can see some hope there. Thanks.
So somebody earlier was saying move the pain. I think that's helps.
So in some ways, I think you almost answered the question that I'm about to ask. But when you have developers traditionally getting access to servers, then one of the reasons that people lost trust in them is because they started fixing problems with, you know, Chmod 777, and that was the solution. So now that they could get access to these systems faster, what can you do to impress on the developers who might not, they might be able to do all these abstractions and lists, but they don't necessarily understand the security implications of some of the choices they're making? And then there's a kind of a follow-on to that. As we build these abstractions and we get farther and farther away from what's actually happening, do you feel that we're losing some of the knowledge about how the systems actually work underneath?
I'll try and answer some of that. So to the question of how do you sort of, where's the feedback loop so that there's at least monitoring and potentially consequences that are more than just, oh, crap, everything blew up, but maybe a report saying, you know, we have these policies, you know, we're not in compliance with these policies. Here are the ways that you are out of compliance. Here are the reasons for these policies. And you know, for the extra points, here are the things that you need to do to be in compliance. And I think that most of that feedback does not happen in a lot of these organizations. And so in a vacuum, you can't just give access. And that's not restricted to developers. It's restricted to everybody, right? It just so happens that we designate some people and say, you are trusted to touch these things. In most cases, we won't actually have any of the same, any of the infrastructure that we would want if we wanted developers to touch those things. But we're going to designate you and pay you to do those things. The tools really need to be there. Again, this is not a problem created by the cloud or created by DevOps. These are problems that have existed, and we have created organizational structures to work around them.
I think it accelerates, though. They've been accelerated on some level.
What do you mean?
That you can do things much faster and more programmatically. So the things that we always had before, the problems we always had before, but they were slow, and we had like slow change management. So that took so long to do that.
Yeah, the changes that now we have to pay attention. Before, previously, we could have ignored it. We could have worked around it. Right. We could have applied more thrust to the pig. But we no longer have that luxury.
Well, I think what's happening is when if people go off the ranch. So it's like, I don't know if anyone's had that experience where there's been something deployed. There's an earlier question about somebody deploying just dev environments and that goes out to production. But has anyone experienced someone in the organization deploying, say, something on EC2 or Rackspace, and then they show up and say, hey, by the way, we're running this infrastructure now. I don't know if that happens at all.
Never.
Yeah, never, right. So, you know, I think the acceleration of that, our hand is being forced by those tools existing outside of the organization. So I think the cloud's accelerating the accelerating DevOps and forcing the issue at hand.
I'd almost compare it to like how you accidentally got Spring in your organization or accidentally got JBoss back in the day.
Or Linux.
It's like, yeah, in Linux. And, you know, because I now that I don't work in, you know, certain enterprises, like I go out for a beer and somebody's like, hey, you know what? You know, our R&D people, we're all running on EC2 now and nobody knows because I got your corporate card and it only costs $30. And it's like, you know, so people are like sneaking in new stuff. And, you know, there's a couple of things. One is the divisive thing that they're sneaking, therefore they're not like, you know, they're not able to express these desires.
But that goes back to the point that Ben made before, that they're working around the processes and the infrastructure that they have available.
Yeah, and I think like, and I don't know if this is going to be solved technology with you know the more you know whether like five different open source like cloud controllers you can run now you know on your I don't know if it's really they hardly ever end up being real technical problems but at least there will be some feasible options but I do think that you know we should expect a lot of developers especially in organizations. That put up a lot of boundaries to work around it. And it's going to be just an issue of whether the manager that gave them the corporate card, you know, what do they have to do? And if does it become an arms race? Like, you know, my security policy versus your credit card.
Go ahead. I wanted to just, I don't know if you know this, Ben, but Amazon, one of their VPs gave this great talk at Lisa this year where they said, you know, the reason we created EC2 in the first place was because we had all these teams that wanted servers and that was the only way we could get them servers was to like build EC2. And that way we could allocate them servers. They could have them and then we could reclaim them when we wanted them. And basically the whole reason Amazon created EC2 in the first place was basically is exactly what you said earlier.
Actually, sort of.
he's on the end. He can't
I mean,
tell you.
It's... You know, everyone's going to have a different version of the story. The version that I will tell is that, like everybody else, with lots of infrastructure and really high growth, we started hitting a wall on how fast we needed to move versus how fast we could actually respond with infrastructure to support it. And that caused us to reevaluate a bunch of stuff. And as part of that process, although there was no thing called DevOps, Amazon was already moving in this direction of what is they call service ownership, where folks who write the code are responsible for the availability of the services. And that may or may not literally mean that developers are carrying pagers. Sometimes it means that there are ops folks on the teams with the developers, right? There are all sorts of ways that it can be actually implemented. Whatever works for you is the right way to do that. But ultimately, they were responsible for their services more and more. And so they had a particular interest in infrastructure that would work for them. And so we had this problem. We can't respond with infrastructure fast enough. We had this opportunity. The developers were uniquely open to collaboration, and we took it. And the end result of that was a totally redesigned infrastructure that was specifically built to be built and allocated quickly. The developers had to make changes to how they built stuff. So, for example, there were no more L2 domains for all of their particular servers. That was gone. But in exchange for that, they got servers, physical servers. We're not talking about virtuals. There was no virtualization involved in any of this. They got physical servers in a few minutes. There were some standard ones that they could pick, and that was that. And it was totally transformative. You don't need all kinds of crazy tools to make that useful. You know, you just want to eliminate the friction. There are sweet spots for infrastructure. There are sweet spots for the software that they're running. And as much as possible, you want those things to overlap. And the best way to do that is to collaborate. So that experience absolutely led directly to saying, you know what, we can package this up even better and put a whole set of interfaces on this. And there can be a whole set of services here, right? And we'll sell those things. And that's the progression, which is why you see things now, public statements by folks like Werner at Structure saying, we're aggressively looking to move our stuff to AWS, right? Didn't start off there because it was never intended to start off there. But it will end up there because that is how Amazon operates.
So, I don't know. You guys ready to go get drinks? So here's the thing, right? How many people, again, were at Velocity this week? All right, so early on I was involved in this process of setting this thing up, and I got lazy and I got kicked off the team. So, okay. But here's the thing, right? One of the questions that came up real early was, if we had it on Friday, are there enough geeks out there to stick around? And here we are at what time? And you're here, so you deserve to give yourself an unbelievable hand. It's been a long week. It's been a great week. This has been awesome stuff. So our panel's done it.